Chapter 5. No Witnesses. Before we begin this chapter, we want to remind you that there are descriptions of violent crime and sexual assault in this story, and it may not be suitable for all listeners. In 2001, Paul finally connected the East Area Rapist attacks to the original Night Stalker attacks, which was the first major break in this case. But what are the original Night Stalker attacks? When did they start? Where and why? To answer that, we need to look at his last attack as the East Area Rapist.
Right now, we're driving on I-80, heading out to the East Bay. We're going to go down to Danville. East on Sycamore Valley is where we have the very last attack in Northern California at East Area Rapist.
It's almost 4 in the morning on July 5th, 1979, when the male victim, a light sleeper, suddenly opens his eyes.
The rapist was standing there, pulling his ski mask over his head, so he didn't have a gun in his hand. So the man started screaming at him, yelling at him.
What the fuck are you doing in here? Get the fuck out of here. While this male is confronting the offender, who's just completely taken aback, the wife gets up and runs out of the bedroom and runs out of that residence. The East Area Rapist is standing there blinking at him like he's just completely befuddled. So after the wife runs out, now the East Area Rapist realizes, okay, I'm done here. He runs out and the husband runs out. You know, everybody's bailing out of that house. And he ends up bouncing over this fence and then running down a green belt that kind of snakes through this whole subdivision. And it looks like he parked his car on that main Sycamore Valley Road. He's sprinting back to his vehicle and getting out because he knows patrol is going to be notified because the victims are out. They're calling law enforcement and he's at least got an advantage, having been on foot, to get to his vehicle and get out to 680 rapidly. And patrol is, of course, they're all focused in on this location here. In many ways, this husband had the best look face-to-face of the East Area Rapist at that time. And he was able to give the artist, sketch artist, accurate descriptions of the shapes of the eyes as well as the lips, and then of course the ski mask. And so with all the composites that we have up to this point, this composite with the ski mask is the one that I've always said that's the best composite we've got, because that's really what the victims were seeing. That is the last known attack in Northern California by the East Area Rapist.
The East Area Rapist loses control of the victims. They escape and may have seen his face. This prompts some detectives to fear that the East Area Rapist may now have a reason to do something he's been threatening to do all along. Kill.
I talked to two psychiatrists during the time, and they both felt the same way. He wants to kill, and he will. And when I asked the doctor, I said, why hasn't he? And she said, well, he hasn't found the justification. But once he finds the justification, that's what he's going to do. And he found the justification when the last attack in our area, the people got away. That was his justification. No one was ever going to get away from him again. And that's when he started killing.
In Sacramento in Contra Costa County, the rest of July 1979 passes without any East Area Rapist attacks. Then nothing in August. And nothing in September. Did he move? Was he arrested? Is he dead? Everyone braces themselves for his return, but he never does. The July 1979 attack in Danville in Contra Costa County is the last attack of the East Area Rapist. He's gone south, and he starts to change his MO in one major way. He begins to kill. There will be no more witnesses. The East Area Rapist has now become the original Night Stalker. He won't be given that name until much later, but it's important to know that his next seven attacks from 1979 to 1986 are known as the original Night Stalker series. On October 1st, 1979, 6 hours south of Sacramento on the Pacific Coast Highway, he returns.
So down in Goleta, California, there is a couple asleep in their bedroom when a masked man comes in. He threatens to kill them, forces the man to lay face down, and throws bindings to the female and makes her tie the man up. She's tying her husband up. Once the husband is tied up, he goes over and ties her up and then proceeds to take her out to the front of the house. He lays her down, and after she's separated from her husband and laying down, she hears him pacing back and forth, and he's saying, "I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him this time. I'm going to kill him." She gets up and runs to the front door. The husband hears that. He gets up and hops out the rear slider door. At this point, the offender has lost control. Next door, an off-duty FBI agent happened to hear this commotion. He grabs his gun and runs out and sees the offender ride right in front of him on a bicycle and disappear down the street. The FBI agent jumps into his car and catches up with the offender, who then dumps his bicycle, starts hopping fences, and disappears.
Police in Santa Barbara have no clue that the most violent serial rapist in California history has just moved into their town. Then Larry Crompton's prediction that the East Area rapist will start killing turns out to be true.
2 months later, Dr. Offerman and Dr. Manning are found shot to death in Dr. Offerman's condominium. The second attack happened just 2 blocks away. Dr. Robert Offerman was a doctor in the Santa Barbara area, and Dr. Deborah Manning was a psychologist out of Santa Maria. They were dating at the time, and Dr. Manning was staying overnight at Dr. Offerman's condominium. When Santa Barbara authorities go in, they see Dr. Offerman nude, laying at the foot of the bed. He's been shot multiple times. Dr. Deborah Manning is found face down on the bed. Her hands are bound behind her, and she's been shot a single time in the back of the head. Dr. Offerman at one point in time had had his hands bound behind his back. It appears that the offender probably left the room, allowing Dr. Offerman to slip his bindings. And when the offender came back in, Offerman got up and tried to make a charge at the offender. This caused the offender to shoot Dr. Offerman multiple times. He goes over and shoots Deborah Manning a single time in the back of the head, and then runs out. Right next door to where the Offerman-Manning homicide occurred, there was a vacant condo. It appears the offender had broken into the vacant condo next door and was able to take his time. He's paying attention to Dr. Offerman and Dr. Manning's activities and then basically laid in wait until he could be confident of being able to silently get inside Offerman-Manning's condo and take control of the situation. So once he enters that condo thinking he's got them at the most optimal time, instead he loses control and ends up having to defensively shoot Offerman.
Investigators speculate that the murders of Offerman and Manning may be related to the East Area rapist, but there seems to be more doubt than certainty.
When I talked to Sergeant William Baker of the Santa Barbara Sheriff's Department, I got a very different view. Baker says it's routine for departments in different counties to discuss cases that might be related. But he says similarities between the Santa Barbara murders and the East Area rapist case have been blown out of proportion. The female victim in Santa Barbara was not raped.
To anyone who knows the East Area rapist attacks as well as Larry Crompton and Paul Holes do, the similarities in the Offerman-Manning double homicide far outweigh the differences. Deborah Manning was bound, and all indications point to the attacker's intent to rape her. It's likely his plan was interrupted. But now, for the first time, he's not leaving any witnesses. He becomes a killer.
So I got those reports. I went over them. And in our mind, we knew that the attempted rape and the murder was the East Area rapist. But nobody would believe us.
While law enforcement debates who's behind the Santa Barbara murders, the killer is about to find his stride.
So in the last Northern California attack in July of 79 in Danville, the offender loses control of those victims. He fails in that case. Then in his first attack down in Goleta, California in October of 79, he loses control. He fails the second time. Now, in the Offerman-Manning double homicide, Dr. Offerman's actions, getting up and charging him, forcing the offender to shoot him, causes him to again lose control of that situation He has to kill Deborah Manning and run out. He does not complete what he wants to do in this case. That's three attacks in a row where he fails. Why doesn't he just stop? I mean, he's elevating the risk to himself with these failures. If he fails again for the fourth time and leaves witnesses alive, he could be caught. But he's got this inner compulsion. He has this need to get that power and control back, get that godlike aura. So he's going to offend again in order to recapture that feeling. That's what he wants. And in many ways, when he does offend again, and this is March 1980 with Lyman and Charlene Smith, this is his opus. This is the case that goes from beginning to end the way he wants it to go.
My name is Steve Rhodes. I'm an investigator with the Ventura County District Attorney's Office. Ventura is 30 minutes from Santa Barbara. In 1980, Ventura was your typical small town beach community. Everybody was real friendly, almost like a retirement community in a way. Very peaceful town. In 1980, I was an ambulance driver in the city of Ventura, and I was sent to the Smith residence when Lyman and Charlene were killed. So it was March 16th. Lyman's son, who was about 12 years old, came over to his father and his stepmother's house to mow the lawn. His parents' car was in the driveway, and he went up and banged on the front door and it got no answer. So he went around the house, found everything else locked up. He encountered a couple of gardeners working, and he asked them if they'd seen his father, and they had not. He went back to the front door, and it was unlocked. He could hear a buzzing sound coming from the back of the house. And he saw that the living room was kind of disheveled in a semi-ransacked attempt. He makes his way back to the bedroom where he's hearing this buzzing sound, and it's the alarm clock on his father's bedside table, and he can see the forms of bodies underneath the blanket. But he doesn't uncover the bodies. He leaves the house and he calls 911, and he tells the police dispatcher and the fire operator that he thinks his parents are dead. Fire and ambulance get dispatched along with the police. And entries made, and sure enough, both adults are found dead underneath the blanket. Then they're covered head to toe. You can't see them at all. House is locked down, and the criminal investigation begins. The crime scene is the master bedroom. There's a quilt laying over the victims, both of whom are face down on the bed. Both are tied hand and foot. Between the bodies is a chunk of firewood that was taken from a stack of firewood that was in the backyard. So the killer had brought this piece of wood into the house and bludgeoned both victims to death with the wood. And he had sexually assaulted Charlene.
These aren't your average victims. In fact, Lyman Smith was a former DA, and then Governor Jerry Brown was considering appointing him to Superior Court judge. This is what we would consider a low-risk victim. Both Lyman and Charlene Smith are well known in the Ventura community.
The primary suspect in the murders is another well-known Ventura resident.
The original investigators really focused in on one of Lyman Smith's business partners, Joe Alsip, and Alsip is actually arrested for that murder.
Joseph Alsip freely admitted that, yes, he was at the Smith home on the evening of the 13th, and the police had determined that the murder had to have happened on the 13th because the number of newspapers that were piled up on the house when the bodies were discovered. Alsip had said he'd been there. He'd shared a beer and a little dinner with both Lyman and Charlene, and he had left. The detectives in Ventura didn't know anything about the murders in Goleta just the month before. So they were centered on Joe Alsip, whose fingerprints were on a drinking glass, and they wound up charging him with the murder. Regrettably, some informant came forward and made some false claims about Joseph's confession to the murder. This was an individual who craved recognition from the police, and Joe spent about a year in jail waiting for his day in court.
We're entering into Nigel Shores. This is where we are having to see or be confronted with the security. And this was in place at the time of the homicides. So I don't know if they're going to allow us in or not. Let me try something.
How you doing?
Hey, I'm a retired investigator that investigated a case that occurred in this neighborhood. Would it be okay for us to just drive around?
You would have to be called in either by the community or the residents.
Okay.
Yeah,
and that's fine. I don't want you to have to,
That's the only way. It would have to be someone calling you in.
Okay.
If you get a hold of the office and talk to them, I'll give you the number if you
That'd
want.
Be great. Thank you.
It's 949.
Hi, Kara. My name is Paul Holes. I'm a retired investigator that investigated an old case that occurred in Nagel Shores way back when. This is regarding the homicide of Keith and Patrice Harrington on Cockleshell back in March of 1980. Sure. No, I can completely understand that. Nope, that's okay. It's a negative. Yeah. So here you have a security system. You have a gated community with a security system, and they have roving security in this neighborhood. Why would he choose to attack here? Because that elevates his risk. I think this is one of those cases where the victims may have been targeted. And it could be as simple as he saw Patrice out at a grocery store and followed her back. Don't know. But it is striking to me that he is choosing to go into this gated and secured community to commit this double homicide.
So in August 1980, down in Nagel Shores, Keith and Patrice Harrington are found bludgeoned to death in their bed. They're both face down. They've each have been hit multiple times in the back of the head with an unknown weapon. We don't know what that weapon is, though there is some thought that the weapon could have been a brass sprinkler head that was probably present within the garage of the house. It appears the offender walked out of that double murder with the weapon. So in this particular case, there's no evidence that he went through the house. He's not ransacking this location. In fact, Patrice's purse is untouched, and he commonly would go in the female victim's purses just to see what was in there, what he could steal, or get the names from their driver's licenses. This is a change for him. Usually, he is going in and he's opening up drawers and he's looking for the jewelry and the cash that he wants to take, the trinkets of souvenirs that he wants to be able to possess. But he doesn't do this in this case. He enters in, he commits this homicide, and then he leaves. He went in to kill. He accomplished what he wanted to do in this case. So my first opportunity to take a look at the crime scenes that occurred down in Orange County was when I took my family to Disneyland. My kids were young at the time. They needed to come back to the hotel room to take a nap. So once they were down for a nap, my wife is left in the hotel room. I sneak out and I go down and I visit the attack locations for Manuela Whittoon and Janelle Cruz. I realized it was only 20 minutes away. So I was able to drive down there, take a look at both those locations, and get back up to the hotel in time to take the kids back to Disneyland. While I'm driving around taking a look at those locations, I am feeling a bit rushed because I knew I had to get back or I'd be facing some angry eyes when I walked in that hotel room if I was late. Okay, so now he's had those three failures in a row and then aha, he's able to succeed. That attack goes the way he wants it to go. And then now he gets down to Nagel Shores with Keith and Patrice Harrington and he succeeds. In that case, it goes exactly the way he wants it to go. At this point, he is feeling empowered again. So right now, we are turning east on Southwood. This is going into the neighborhood where Manuela Whittoon was killed back in February of 1981 in Irvine, California. Back at the time of the Manuela Whittoon case, Irvine was a very, very small town. A lot of the land that we see today that is all filled and built up with commercial buildings, it was vacant at the time. It was all orchards. Manuela Whittoon's parents were from Germany. However, Manuela had been in the U.S. for a while. She and her husband had been married for a few years. I had heard that she had heard about these types of cases and was paranoid about possibly becoming a victim. And I have seen that in other cases.
So we're here on Columbus Drive in Irvine, California. This is where the February 1981 homicide of Manuela Whittoon occurred. In that particular case, it looked like the offender had
prowled through the neighborhood a little bit and ended up accessing the Whittune backyard through going over the fence on the south side of the house. There was a shoe impression on the top of the neighbor's gas meter. It appears that he used as a step to look over the fence before he jumped over it, and then probably got a sense where Manuela was inside the house. He used a screwdriver and pried the rear slider open, leaving the screwdriver on the patio. It was actually collected as an item of evidence.
Our job was to take the paint that's on that screwdriver, give it to the lab, and see if they can determine what type of paint that was.
Larry Montgomery was one of the original Irvine PD investigators on the case.
According to the victim's husband, David Whittune, he had never seen that screwdriver before. So the assumption was, if he's telling the truth, that that screwdriver was brought by the suspect.
He entered into the residence. Manuela Whittune's husband had been hospitalized with a virus and was not home on the evening of that attack. Manuela was probably asleep in her bed, and that's where he attacked her. He sexually assaulted her and ended up bludgeoning her. She's inside a sleeping bag, so it had been covering her head for some of the blows. Initially, the thought is, well, did the offender use the sleeping bag purposefully? But in talking to the husband, well, that's how Manuela would sleep. There is evidence that she had been bound. He had removed the bindings and actually took the bindings with him this time. So this was a change in his MO. In the previous cases, he either left the bindings on the victim or, in the Harrington case, had left them on the bed.
Some other issues on the Whittune case were interesting and a little different. The answering machine for the phone was one of those that had one little tape recording in it for your messages to be put on when somebody left a message. It had another separate recording that was for a message that the Whittunes would leave on that for anybody who called. And it would usually say, you know, this is the Whittunes, leave a message. And then the other recording would record the message. Those two little areas where the tapes were opened and the tapes were gone. Why did he take those? Why would he actually need to take those two recordings unless maybe he left a message on it? Maybe he left a message and maybe Manuel knows him. And maybe after he killed her, he needed to take those in order not to be identified.
The husband had this reel-to-reel tape player. And when he comes home and he's looking at what had happened inside his house, he had noticed that a reel had been placed on that player. And he told the investigators, I didn't do that. So I start looking into the possibility, well, if the offender did that, why? Why is he putting that reel on there? Is he touching it with bare hands? Could we get his fingerprints off of that reel? Is there any magnetic tape where he may have recorded himself? Because that's something we know that this offender possibly could have done. He likes to call the victims. Maybe he left a recorded message. So when they played that tape, he's further tormenting the people who are listening to it. Unfortunately, no fingerprints were recovered off that reel. And when that reel was opened up from its original packaging, whatever magnetic tape had been on there, if any, wasn't there.
There was a TV, and not a good TV. It wasn't like a fancy TV. They had a better TV in the house. But an older, black and white looking big TV was taken out of the house by the killer and propped up against the wall in the back of the house.
So with this TV that had been taken out of the house and put on the back patio, one of the theories is that he may have needed to use that TV in order to get up over the fence. We know our offender is extremely capable of jumping fences. So at this point, why would he need to use this TV to step on in order to be able to go over the fence? There was some thought and discussion amongst the investigators that, well, maybe because of his age and or injury, he was less physically capable at the time of the Manuela Whittune attack and needed that TV sort of as a stepping stool to get up over the fence on his escape. However, when I take a look at this TV, I'm looking for evidence that it had been stepped on. I'm looking for disturbances to the top of the TV, whether it be structurally, whether it be a soil that had been left behind. I'm looking at the position of the TV relative to the fence. How far away is it? What I'm noticing is there does not appear to be any indicators that had been stepped on.
It certainly wasn't something you'd steal and take with you. So that seemed odd. So was that something that a person who really wasn't a burglar tried to make it look like it was a burglary. So that was a question that we had.
To some detectives at the time, the TV in the yard made the crime scene look staged.
Who needs to fake a scene? It would have to be somebody close who doesn't want to be identified who would fake a scene. Certainly her husband was somebody to look at as a possibility. Could it have been him? I was looking at exactly what David Whithune did in the hospital. If he did it, he had to sneak out of the hospital and be gone for over an hour to get away, get home, kill his wife, get back, and risk somebody not seeing him for, you know, coming in and finding him gone and looking for him. Could he have done it if in the middle of the night nobody went and checked him? Possibly. I did discover that they had phone records. The phone that was next to David Whithune's bed at the hospital, and what I found very interesting and kind of from a humanistic, what do people do? I looked at the next morning, I think it was 7 o'clock, it showed he picked up the receiver and dialed his wife's phone number. And it was on for a certain amount of time, which I timed it, and it was like about 8 rings that it would take before he hung up. And then he immediately picked up the phone, and I was thinking to myself, if I was in his position, if I'm innocent, and I call my wife and I know she's supposed to be home, and I let it ring 8 times, she doesn't answer, and what would I be thinking? I would be thinking, boy, did I misdial? She should be answering. And what he did is exactly what I would do. He immediately dialed the exact same number, and then he left it ringing for 20 times. And she didn't answer.
It's hard to know if the killer actually planned this attack with the husband being away, or whether it was just coincidence that the husband happened to come down sick and was in the hospital. We know this offender is not afraid to kill when there's a man present. We'll never know for sure if he planned to attack with the male outside the house, but if the husband was there that night, he probably would have been killed too.
Manuela Whithune is the 7th murder victim of the East Area Rapist. At this point in 1981, no one knows these murders are the work of a serial killer, let alone the East Area Rapist. The murders in Santa Barbara haven't been connected to Orange County or Ventura. There are no witnesses. DNA is not in use. The investigators have very little to go on. And no one knows whether this killer is going to attack again or where.
So right now we're driving north on I-5. We're in Irvine, California area. If we were to continue driving another 200 miles northwest from here, we would reach Santa Barbara. That's where we have 3 of the Southern California cases. The first one, the second one, and the 5th one.